This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Chris Morgan, a conservation ecologist specializing in international bear research and conservation. In 2007, Chris co-founded Wildlife Media, a nonprofit that creates films and funding campaigns for global wildlife. He also serves as co-director of the Grizzly Bear Outreach Project in the North Cascades of Washington State. In 2003, he was honored by the Environmental Education Association of Washington as Outstanding Environmental Educator of the Year. Chris Morgan is here today to tell us about the status of the world's bears and to discuss his film, Bear Trek. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me.
What led to your personal interest in bears?
It's a strange thing, isn't it, you know, for an Englishman to be into bears as much as I am. But, yeah, it's been a fascination for me for the last 20 years or so. I'm an ecologist, but that kind of came after me discovering bears and the role that they can play in ecosystems and conservation and just how fascinating they are as creatures. And it all started when I was 18 years old. I'm 40 now. So over 20 years ago, I was working on a summer camp in New Hampshire. And it was a conservation camp where young kids learnt about wildlife. I was a counselor there looking after the kids and teaching them what I knew, which wasn't very much compared to most of the kids in a wild part of New Hampshire. Every week these different speakers would come in, and a moose biologist came in once, and there was a coyote biologist came in to talk to the kids. And then one day this guy appears, and he's a black bear biologist, and he was working in the White Mountain National Forest just north of where the camp was in New Hampshire. And he appeared and started telling stories about how he was capturing bears in the local area and trying to learn about them for their conservation. And, you know, bear in mind, I'm a young Englishman at this point, fresh off the boat for a summer experience in the States. And I just thought, wow, you can be a bear biologist? That's the craziest thing I've ever heard in my life, you know. And I was hooked, and I begged the guy to come out into the field with him. And he, you know, kind of put me off to start with and was a busy guy. Finally, he picked me up one night. It was about 9 o'clock at night. And he said, come on, I'm taking you out into the field. I said, wow, great. But it's nighttime. He said, yeah, I'll show you why. So we drove down into the main town there, the town of Berlin in New Hampshire. And we pulled up. I said, where are we going? He said, we're going to the study site. I said, where on earth is it? And he pulled us up at the garbage dump. And there were 14 black bears all lit up by moonlight in this garbage dump. And we spent the evening tranquilizing them and radio collaring them. And then I tracked them for the summer with him and had an amazing time. And at that point, I was going to be a graphic designer. I was all planning on coming home to England to study graphic design. But the breaks went on and I decided I was going to be a bear ecologist instead.
Why are bears important ecologically?
That's a great question. I think a lot of people have no idea how important they are as ecological indicators for healthy ecosystems in places where, you know, on a planet really where we are short of very wild locations and pristine wilderness these days. And bears, they qualify really in three ways. And in one way, they're an indicator species. So they speak to the health of an ecosystem. If you've got a healthy population of grizzly bears, for example, we've got a small number of grizzly bears on the doorstep here in the Cascades. There is a small number of them there, and it tells us that that ecosystem has got everything that that bear population or those individuals might need. Plenty of space, plenty of fresh water, plenty of resources in terms of food for them. So they're a good indicator. They're also an umbrella species, and so when you're protecting a viable population of bears anywhere in the world, you're also protecting everything underneath their umbrella, as we call it ecologically. And that means, you know, sometimes thousands of other species of plants and animals. And so that they make a really good barometer of ecosystem health in that way. And in another way, they actually do improve ecosystem function. So grizzly bears, let's stick with them for an example. They dig a lot for either ground squirrels or for roots and tubers and bulbs of plants. And in doing so, they aerate the soil a lot. I mean, they can decimate a hillside. It's incredible to see them in action with those giant claws that they have on their front paws. And so they aerate the soil. They make it very, very fertile for plants to grow. They clean up carcasses that might have been hunted and left by wolves and coyotes and others. So they're very much an ecosystem cleanup function as well. And so they play various roles, and all of them pretty important.
Would you say a few words about the different species of bears worldwide, where they are located, and their diversity?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. A lot of people are completely blown away to find out that there's as many bear species as there are around the world. There's 8 species around the world, and we're lucky enough to have 3 of them in North America. We've got grizzly bears, sometimes they're called brown bears when they're on the coast, polar bears, and North American black bears. And there's a really good example just in North America alone. Those 3 species are found. One of them's super common, the black bear. There's probably 3/4 of a million North American black bears in North America, in Canada, the US, and Mexico. Here in the Cascades, we've got around 10 grizzly bears left in the North Cascades Mountains of Washington State. And so everything in between. We've also got polar bears, as I mentioned. Those three are in North America. But there are 8 bear species internationally. So you get bears in some really wild, isolated, obscure places that you might not initially think of and consider as bear country. I think in North America, we always think, oh, the grizzly bear, you know, it's the first one that springs to mind. We've all seen Grizzly Adams, you know, and you picture the Rocky Mountains initially, and that's bear country. Well, there are also bears in Borneo. There are bears in Peru. There are bears in parts of Europe, not in Britain where I'm from, but even there we had brown bears, the same as our grizzly bears here till 1,000 years ago. But the Romans and grizzly bears didn't get along very well in Britain, and so the bears lost. The Romans won out. But 1,000 years ago, grizzly bears were wiped into extinction in Britain. But they still cling on in small pockets of populations in other parts of Europe. In Spain, that's one place where they've managed to cling on. There's about 70 brown bears in the north of Spain, in the Cordillera Cantabrica. In Italy, there are 2 populations in Italy of brown bears. One of them's an hour from Rome. And it's one of the places we're going to be filming for Bear Trek, the film that we're creating about the bears of the world. There are Asiatic black bears in the center of Asia. There are sloth bears in India. India, in fact, has Asiatic black bears, sloth bears, sun bears, and brown bears. 4 species. They even beat North America in terms of the diversity of bear species they've got in that one country. And it's amazing to think that a country, large as it is, but a country with so many people in it can support viable populations of 4 different bear species, because bears can be pretty demanding creatures in terms of the space that they need and the resources and food that they need. So there are 8 bear species around the world, and they're found in everything from the high Arctic, the white Arctic landscape that the polar bear calls home, through to some of the most incredibly rich, biodiverse tropical forests in places like Borneo, where the sun bear persists, and everything in between.
How different are some of the species in these other places compared to the ones we have here in North America?
That's a great question. Some of them are very similar in terms of the type of habitat that they use, the way that they look. Brown bears are sort of globally one of the more common bears. And I use brown bear and grizzly bear interchangeably. It's the same species, Ursus arctus, is the Latin name, the scientific name for brown bears or grizzly bears. So they call them brown bears in Italy and in Spain, and we call them grizzly bears in the interior of North America. Brown bears around the Northern Hemisphere, there's about 180,000 of them. They can look very similar, but even within that species, they vary quite a lot. So a good example of it is you get barren ground grizzly bears. They're on the north slope, close to the Arctic, above the Arctic Circle in many cases. So let's take Northern Canada, for example. I worked up there in the Northwest Territories near the town of Inuvik about 15 years ago on a grizzly bear project. We were capturing grizzly bears and radio collaring them and monitoring their home ranges there. And they were really small. The bears were small, but their ranges were giant, absolutely enormous, vast tracts of wild land up on the tundra because it's very poor quality habitat. There isn't much to eat when you're a grizzly bear up on the North Slope. And so they have these large home ranges in order to fulfill their needs, their daily calorific needs. So the bears are quite small, but with big, large ranges. You know, a big female might weigh 250 pounds, 300 pounds. A big male, maybe 400 pounds up there. And then if you switch to other brown bears, let's take the coastal part of Alaska, where we filmed for Bear Trek in Katmai National Park. They're the biggest, most monstrous proportion bears you've seen anywhere in the world. And the reason for that is their habitat is intact and it's very, very rich in food resources. And the key element of the food resources there is salmon. So these bears are eating salmon, especially in the late summer season and early fall. And they can pack on 25 or 30,000 calories a day, these bears. So they're walking around and they're carrying sometimes 1,500 pounds. They're 1,500 pounds in their weight. The largest of them, even bigger, big, big males used to get to sort of 1,900 pounds. So you compare that to a 300-pound bear of exactly the same species found in the Canadian Arctic, and you can see this huge variety even within species. And then the tropical bears are very different to the temperate bears. So sun bears in Borneo are small. You know, a big male might be 150 pounds, a tiny little tropical bears that spend a lot of time in trees and eating fruit. So there's a huge variety. Sloth bears in India eat termites, so you hear them before you see them. So the incisors of a sloth bear are missing from its mouth. So it's able to vacuum up termites from termite nests. And so you literally hear this sound, you know, from 100 or 200 yards away, and it's usually a sloth bear feeding on termites. So, yeah, huge variety in the way they behave and the way they look.
I'm Diane Horn, and we're speaking with Chris Morgan, Executive Director of Wildlife Media and Co-Director of the Grizzly Bear Outreach Project. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you briefly describe what the life of a bear is like? Perhaps you could take a species or two and describe the activities during a day and then during a year.
You know, this summer I was privileged to spend a lot of time camping among these big brown bears that I was just talking about on the coast of Alaska for another film that we're doing for PBS. And so it was a real immersion into the bear's world there. And it's a place where I go every year, but I usually just spend a week or two there and I take a small group of people up to see the bears and understand what their daily lives are like and to experience them up close and personal. But this year I didn't have people with me other than this film crew. And so we parked ourselves out there in this base camp, middle of nowhere, real isolated wilderness on the Alaska coast. And we were surrounded by bears the whole time. And these brown bears, one thing that always strikes me about them is their adaptability. They're incredible. So they'll emerge from a den. Let's take a female with cubs. They emerge from the den in about March or April time. Females only breed once every 3 or 4 years, because when they're with cubs and the cubs are with her for that period of time, she doesn't breed. She doesn't mate with males when she's got the cubs with her. So they come out in the springtime. The first thing that they hit when they come out of that den, they've been in there for 6 months. So she's not been eating herself, and the cubs have been suckling from her milk. So she's really quite thin and desperate to eat at this point. First thing they go to is sedges. So they start to eat sedges in these giant meadows up there that are starting to flourish in the springtime. And then they'll switch also to feeding on clams. They'll dig clams out of the sand. And they're very, very smart at figuring out where the food is that they need and when they need it. And they'll go to the same spot every time they need that particular food item. And every single year, they know exactly where they should be during which season to find which food. It's pretty amazing, you know, because they're big animals. They need calories. And so it's important for mum to know that. And so mum also passes this information on to the cubs. She's teaching them all the time. And they're with her for 3 long years and learning every step of it. You know, we were watching this female with cubs there this year. And we were the first people that these cubs had ever seen when they came out of this den. They were tiny. I mean, they could practically fit into the palm of your hand, each of them, when we first laid eyes on them. And they stood up on their back legs and were kind of freaking out. Like, what are these biped, hairless mammals in front of us, you know? And there we were. And the female had seen me before. She knew me from previous years and seen enough people to know that we weren't a threat. So she was fine, just busy grazing on sedges. And the whole time, the cubs are trying to figure out what the heck we were. So they're learning all the time. And by the time we'd spent several weeks with them, they were completely comfortable. They were as relaxed as the mum was in terms of our presence and being close to us. Later on in the season, she would switch to feeding on salmon. And she's teaching the cubs how to feed on salmon. And so they're up all spring and summer and into the fall. And about this time of year, we're in early November now, about this time of year, most of those females, with young cubs especially, are denned up. In fact, most bears are denned up in North America, grizzly bears and black bears, that is. So they den up because they don't have anything to eat over the winter time, and it's a good way to sort of avoid that problem, sleep through it, and then wake up in the spring when food is available. And so they live for about 25 years, if they're lucky. And they don't mate for life, so the males and females would get together for a real distinct breeding season. That's something else we witnessed this year. Dozens of bears out on this meadow. I called it the love zone. It was an incredible scene. Lots of bears entering this meadow and trying to figure out where they stood in a hierarchy, who was potentially a mate and who wasn't, which of the males were big and tough and which ones could be threatened. And it was fascinating behavior patterns between all of these bears. It was really a wonder to watch it all. And the other thing that really strikes me about a bear and what they are as creatures is super smart, very, very intelligent. And there are some mammalogists that compare them. Well, most people agree that primates are the most intelligent, perhaps followed by whales and dolphins. And there are some behavioral ecologists out there that suggest that bears should be third in that list. Super smart animals and capable of learning, remembering, teaching, reapplying knowledge over space and time. Things that are beyond most animals, that's for sure, yeah.
How are the bears of the world faring overall?
That's a good question. There are 8 species. Most of them aren't doing very well. 5 of them are in dire straits. You name it, the threats that are facing wildlife and wild places the world over are exactly those facing bears, and which is why, as an ecologist, you know, people ask me why bears. All right, they're cool, they're smart, they're charismatic, they're powerful, all these things. But as an ecologist, I use them as an indicator. I use them to get people's attention, sort of draw them in with grizzly bears and leave them with earthworms, I say. You know, I mean, using these species that are charismatic and eye-catching is a really good way to get people engaged in conservation and ecology and figuring out what these wild places that we all need depend upon and what they need to persist into the future. And so these bears, the threats that face them are everything from climate change, which is the obvious one in the case of polar bears, and they've been getting so much attention for that recently. Just 2 weeks ago, I was up in Kaktovik on the north slope of Alaska, watching polar bears wait for the sea ice to freeze. We were up there filming them, and no matter how much you hear through the media, through colleagues, through science, about polar bears and facing climate change, it's not till you're looking into the eyes of those bears as they're waiting for the sea ice to freeze up that you really realize, wow, this is real. This is as real as it gets for these animals. This sea ice is not freezing as soon as it should be. We were up there, and during part of our stay, it was raining, and it should have been minus 30 at that point. And we were waiting for this small lagoon to freeze up so the bears could get onto it and feel very comfortable with their environment. It's amazing that they're more comfortable on ice than in water or on land. And it didn't freeze up while we were there. In fact, we packed our bags and left early because we couldn't wait any longer for the water to freeze up. And the ice, the main bulk of the sea ice, the permanent sea ice, was about 80 miles offshore. And in many cases, it's too far for the bears to swim back and forth from the ice to the land as they need to. And so the climate change is having a real impact on polar bears. That's a really obvious one, I think. Thank goodness people are really paying attention to that. And then in other parts of the world, here in the Cascades, grizzly bears are so few on the ground. What they face is males simply can't find females or vice versa. Let's suppose there are 10 of them. There may be only 5 of them. About half a population is usually females, but that means that there's perhaps 1, 2, 3 females tops in a population out there, and the males have a hard time finding them. So you can see the problems there that occur. You know, the bears have no one to reproduce with, so they're not going to bounce back quickly in terms of their population. That's another huge problem with small populations of bears around the world, everywhere. And then deforestation and habitat loss. And bears face it on all fronts. In Borneo, where we filmed sun bears, these little vulnerable creatures, you know, they're 150 pounds, like I say, they're the smallest bear species in the world, and they're found in one of the most biodiverse places in the world. These forests are incredible. When I was there, I used to think, wow, every inch of space and sound is occupied in this forest, you know. It was one of the noisiest places. But there, they were found in these small pockets, these reserves that were being encroached upon on all sides by fragmentation, legal and illegal logging, and basically destruction of the habitat that the sun bears in that population faced. And so, yeah, very similar problems to many of the wildlife species that we hear about. But some good things that we can do to help protect what's left, for sure.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Chris Morgan, Executive Director of the International Conservation Group Wildlife Media and Co-Director of the Grizzly Bear Outreach Project. What is the relationship of humans to bears in the different ecosystems for bears that have been studied?
It's an interesting one. I think, you know, in the mind's eye, bears have always had a really close relationship with people. People have had... They've respected and revered bears for thousands of years, and we hear about it all the time in Native American culture especially, and Inuit culture. Recently up on the North Slope there, looking at the polar bear situation, I was lucky enough to hang out with some Inuit Alaskan Eskimos, and it was a fascinating time to spend time with people that had this very strong kinship, almost like a brotherly kinship with the wildlife there. It was absolutely wonderful. I loved it. And you see that with all of the bear species wherever they are, in many cases anyway. Sometimes there's conflict involved, and there are some people who don't want bears because they see them as a threat to their livelihood or to their safety. But in many cases, those feelings run a lot deeper. In Peru, for example, in South America, there are certain local tribes there that believe that Andean bears were once women, and that Andean bears living around a village would steal women away from those villages, and they would become bears in the forest alongside these Andean bears. And that's where these Andean bears stemmed from. They used to be women from local villages. And there's all this folklore that revolves around that. And the mythology is absolutely fascinating. Wherever you go, you find intriguing stories, and some of them quite positive. In Borneo as well, there was this situation where the local people feared sun bears in some ways. These sun bears were very often secretive and elusive and never seen very much. And in Borneo, people didn't want to venture into certain parts of the forest there because they were afraid that these are the smallest bears in the world. You know, they look like a large dog. And you wonder what people might be afraid of. But apparently, these bears will run through these tunnels of forest and grab you by the ankles when you're least expecting it. And so there was this element of fear for local people there, for sure. So it's another interesting thing about bears of the world, you know, that the relationship with humans runs from very, very positive to quite negative in some cases.
Would you now speak about your film, Bear Trek? First, what's the goal of the film? What do you hope it's going to accomplish?
Funds for wildlife conservation. It's all about generating dollars for bear conservation and conservation of wild places around the world that bears and other wildlife depend upon. And really, it's just an imaginative way of accomplishing that goal. And for quite a few years, I've devoted my time to conservation and to getting word out about wildlife. I'm an ecologist, so I've done research on wildlife, and I've done environmental education programs on wildlife. And it just seems that, wow, media is a great way to get people engaged, show people an inspiring, thought-provoking, tear-jerking film, and it can turn them to action. You know, we always say that good films can inspire change, and that's exactly what we've got in mind with Bear Trek. So I've worked on all four continents where bears are found, and in every single situation, whether it was in Spain or in the Arctic of Canada, in Pakistani Himalayas, in Ecuador, in every single situation, there were people doing great things on the ground for wildlife, and in this case for bears. But they weren't always getting the exposure that they needed, and certainly weren't getting the dollars that were needed in order to protect the bears that they were studying and the ecosystems and help the local people. And so everywhere I went, I found this exact same picture repeated. So I started to think, what's going to get these people and the bears the attention that they need, the exposure that they need, and the funds that they need? And so we started Wildlife Media, myself and a local cinematographer from Seattle, Joe Pontecorvo. John Taylor was a guy who stepped in and has become a core part of our organization. He stepped in as a donor to start with, and now he's the chairman of our nonprofit board. Annie Mize, a local person here in Seattle also, is on our board. So we have this small family of people here. A guy named Matt Ficus recently joined us, and he's based here in Seattle as well. So it's a tiny team of people, and what we're trying to do is tell stories, compelling conservation stories from the bear world, from these obscure, really quite wondrous locations around the world where people are surprised to hear that there are bears. And then the film will be put out in the movie theaters when we complete it within this next couple of years, and then all the profits go back to the projects that you've just watched in the film. But more than that, along the way, we're helping to fund these projects too. So we've filmed in Alaska, the big brown bears of Katmai that I mentioned to you. We've also filmed in Borneo, the smallest bears in the world, the sun bears down there. And so we were going for this huge contrast. Those are the first two locations we've filmed in. And people can enjoy a 20-minute segment of our film online if they go to our website. And they'll see this contrast between Alaska and Borneo. And it's an amazing thing to think that these bears are related in any way, because they're 2,000 pounds in Alaska and they're 200 pounds in Borneo, and very, very different habitats. And now we're saving up and pushing to finish the film, fundraising for it to get to places like Peru and Italy. And the big push that we've got on at the moment is to try and get back to Peru in January to film the Andean bear there. And there's a great effort that one of our colleagues who got in touch with us after hearing about Bear Trek, her name is Robin Appleton, and she's working down there with Andean bears. And she's found this location where Andean bears are not only visible, but actually quite filmable, and in some cases actually are approaching her. So they've not seen humans before. It's a very isolated location in the northern part of Peru. And she called me and said, this was about a year and a half ago. And she said, Chris, I've heard about Bear Trek. Can you come down and film our Andean bears in Peru? And I said, yeah, that's not very likely, you know, because I know how difficult it is to find this species. And I'd spent a couple of years looking for them in Ecuador, literally 2 years on and off, and never laid eyes on a single Andean bear. And then here's this woman calling me saying, oh, we've got bears that you can film. And so we've been working hard to try and get down there in January to film her project. But in the meantime, we've been funding her work down there. So it's a great example of what we're doing along the way through Wildlife Media and Bear Trek to help projects. So we helped her to satellite collar some bears. We've helped to pay for some housing down there that she's building for the local community. We've paid for salaries. So the biggest bear hunter from this community is now the biggest bear conservationist. Of course, being an ex-hunter, he was the best tracker available. So Robin hired him with some funding from us to work for her and track these bears through the northern forests of Peru there. So it's been incredible. And then just this week, we heard from Robin, and she has told us that because of her work and the radio-collared bears and tracking their movements there that we've been supporting, it's now become a national park. It's like the best success story you can imagine. So these bears are going to be protected in perpetuity there, which is exactly what wildlife media is about. It's about using these bear species and triggering conservation initiatives and triggering action and making things happen on the ground. And we do that through the exposure that we can get through beautiful films and through the funds that those films generate. Just this week, just recent news, hot off the press, I heard from Robin, and she said one of the first bears that they collared down there, her name is Laura. Laura has just had a cub. And for us to even know that is incredible with Andean bears. It's such a very rare thing. And just this morning, I got some photographs of this cub, and it's like, wow, it's almost like it's our child. You know, we've all become a mum. It's incredibly good news that this tiny little cub, this Andean bear, one of the rarest bear species in the world, has now come into the world, and it's partly because of Robin's work protecting this great area and the work she's doing with the local people there. So that's what we're all about, is getting funds and exposure to these places around the world that need it.
Well, we're running short of time, but let's just say a few words about the grizzly bears in the North Cascades in Washington State. You're the co-director of the Grizzly Bear Outreach Project. Would you briefly tell us about the project?
Yes, it's the North Cascades. We've got 10,000 square miles of decent wilderness on our doorstep here, and we're very lucky sort of in the global perspective to have that big chunk of land. But one thing we don't have is very many grizzly bears, and there are thought to be as few as 10 of them. There used to be thousands in this ecosystem, but they were slowly wiped to close to extinction over the last couple of hundred years since European settlers arrived. And so the Grizzly Bear Outreach Project, I work with a team of people on this project that are scattered through the North Cascades and work very closely with communities to try and bring information to people about what are grizzly bears, what do they eat, what's the level of danger being in grizzly bear country in reality, what's it going to take to bring more grizzly bears back to this ecosystem, what's the legalities of that, how does it work through the Endangered Species Act, etc., etc. So we've been working for about 7 years in the Cascades now to try and bring information to people about what grizzly bears are. And without poking anyone in the chest and telling them that they need grizzlies for one reason or the other, far be it from me with this weird accent to be doing that, you know. We're very much more about providing information and letting people make their own minds up about how they feel about these large carnivores in an ecosystem that's shared with people.
What kind of recovery plan for grizzlies is there at present?
Well, in the lower 48, there are certain things happening in certain parts of the lower 48, mostly in the Rocky Mountains, to help bring grizzly bears back. And here in the North Cascades, we're a little bit behind. We've got some great education programs going on. And there is talk of doing an environmental impact statement, which looks at all of the alternatives that are out there for bringing bears back in reality. And one of those realities could be importing bears and propping up this population using bears from other ecosystems where they're healthy enough to take bears out of and put them into the North Cascades, so that the gene pool would be increased, the number of bears would increase, and we overcome the problem I was describing earlier on of simply not enough bears to reproduce in this tiny population to ever bound back. So there are certain steps being considered at this point, and all the way along, the Fish and Wildlife Service is really keen and obliged, actually, to pull in the public, to tell them what's going on with this process of bringing grizzly bears back into the Cascades, if that ever does happen, if it's ever decided that that's the way to go ahead. And so GBOP, the Grizzly Bear Outreach Project, is really positioned to help that process to be as fluid as possible as well. You know, engaging people in the process, really, you know, making sure that people are part of the return of this great carnivore to the Northwest.
Well, we're out of time, but what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
That's an easy one. What's good for bears is good for people. I think that, you know, the more we can work to conserve massive chunks of wild land for species like grizzly bears and sun bears around the world, the better off we'll all be. So, yeah, what's good for bears is good for people. It's a good mantra.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Chris.
Thank you.
We have just been speaking with Chris Morgan, Executive Director of the International Conservation Group Wildlife Media and Co-Director of the Grizzly Bear Outreach Project. For more information, check on the web at www.wildlifemedia.org and also bearinfo.org. Again, wildlifemedia.org and bearinfo.org. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.